Blog Talk Radio.
Well, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to see if we can get the intro up. I understand Blog Talk is having some difficulty right now. So, if it just starts on its own here in a few minutes, we'll understand. Because, you know, once in a while, there's plenty of internet problems that can occur that we have nothing.
Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach, compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people. Every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting
email from a group of people who actually had seen me doing a local television segment. And, you know, I have to admit that I was really taken aback by some information that I got on Jared Fogel. You may know that he is from Indianapolis, and he is the subway guy. And it looks like Jared has had significant difficulty with being in prison. He was initially sentenced to this prison because it had sexual addiction treatment. Now, I have no idea whether Jared Fogel has a sexual addiction, but, you know, I would suspect he has something called sexual exploitive disorder, because of the offenses that he was proven guilty of, the fact that he solicited that were underage, and the fact that he had lots and lots of pornographic images of underage kids. And so I got contacted by the television station this week, and they asked me to comment on the fact that Jared Fogel had been in communication with an ex-prostitute who actually had solicited him while he was in jail. She had checked in on him, said she was sorry to see the trouble he was going through. And, you know, I don't know what the deal is, but she had a letter that was allegedly written by him. And in this letter, Jared said, you know, please keep writing me. Please send me pictures. And I don't mean that they were explicit pictures, but it was obvious that he was very lonely and he wanted a relationship. But in the course of this email, he said that he had not done the things that he was accused of, that the media had made it way worse than it was, that his partner had a lot of problems, but that he didn't. And one of the things that I commented on is that sex addicts, so oftentimes when they're not in good, solid recovery, they minimize, rationalize, justify. They use a variety of what we call defense mechanisms to, you know, continue their behaviors. You know, when I first meet addicts that are not in good, solid recovery, they may say something like, well, I wasn't having sex with my wife or husband. That's why I acted out. But what we know is it's never about what's going on in the coupleship that causes the sexual addiction. It can certainly be grounds for excuse making. You know, I always say when it comes to recovery, that may be a reason that contributed to your problem, but it's certainly not the excuse. Because you've heard me say it before, we are all 100% responsible for our behavior. And that is just the way it is. We are 100% responsible for our behavior, and it's never anybody else's fault that we're having an issue. And I would imagine that you feel the same way, too. And so I went ahead and I said, you know, here's a man who allegedly is in treatment in a prison. He has had some horrendous things happen to him. He was beat up severely. And, you know, the general consensus on that when people are talking about it is, well, he deserved it. And I, as a therapist who works in this field, I do not believe you ever deserve to be physically assaulted. You know, an eye for an eye does not apply in my book. And so, but what I did say is, you know, for him to minimize and defend and rationalize and justify, he's not in good enough treatment, as well as if you are in recovery yourself, you know that you're never supposed to get involved with somebody your first year of recovery because you need to be working on yourself. And so that was problematic, too. And of course, I was saddened by the fact that this prostitute, although she is not a prostitute allegedly today, contacted him and then threw him under the bus and went to the news station and said, look, I'm horrified at what he has said. So I was explaining a little bit about this addictive behavior and recovery. And I got my first piece of angry email, and it came from a man that actually we ended up having a pretty good dialogue. But, you know, he basically said he thought I was saying, you know, Jared's a creep, and how dare you think an eye for an eye, and why would you throw him under the bus? You don't know how hard he's worked. And you know, television segments are really hard for me to do. I love them. I love getting on television and disseminating information, but that's what I try to do. I never want to act like I know what somebody is going through, because what I know is that I don't know. You know, yes, in this field, you learn about predictability, and you learn what is very typical in regards to responses. You get to see somebody's denial. I've told you before, the first task of really working through the addiction is breaking through the denial. So whenever I'm commenting on a person, I'm really commenting on sexual addiction anyway. And that's what I hope to do. I am a psychoeducational facilitator. I'm a therapist. I'm a coach. I'm obviously a certified sexual addictions therapist, but I really want to educate people so that they know if they have a problem, why they might have a problem, and what they need to do about it. And that's, you know, hey, that's what this show is all about. Now, I got to tell you, I feel like I've been with you all week. And the reason is that we're putting together an ebook on sexual addiction with 10 in the field. And I'm putting it together. It is, like, exhausting. I'm spending hours and hours and hours on it. They're transcripts from the show, and I've picked specialized subjects. Of course, I put Patrick Carnes in there. He's the father of sexual addiction. And I put myself in there. I don't think I'm an expert, but I thought it's my book. It's my radio show. I'm going to put me in there, too. But in addition to that, I have put Ken Adams, who talks about enmeshment, and Barbara Steffens, who talks about partner recovery, and Michael Barta, who does attachment and what trauma is like, and Claudia Black, who talks about being deceived as a partner, and Phil Hartman, who talks about attachment theory. And so I've just got these great, great interviews, and I've been putting them together and learning a lot about how to write an ebook. Even though I've done some manuals, this is a little bit different. And so what I'm going to ask of you all, once I get it done, I'm going to ask for you to spend the $9.99 to download the ebook, and to know that every penny other than, oh, you know, I think it's 15% will go to addiction research for sexual addiction, AFAR. And I am so proud of that organization because they are compiling research to show that addiction is an addiction. It's not a moral issue. It's not boys being boys. It's not girls gone wild. It is a compulsive, a sexually compulsive illness that unless you get the formula right, you don't know how to break the chains of the addiction. And so I just know that my listeners are going to buy this book, help support research so that we can make this addiction prevalent enough that people get it. They understand. They start having treatment centers specifically for it that are funded by Medicare and Blue Cross Blue Shield. And, you know, just in the same way as now there are available treatment centers all over the country that get reimbursed by insurance for alcoholism and drug addiction. So I feel so fortunate to be in the grassroots of that and to be donating my time to get this book together. I think I'll have it done by this week, and then I think it'll take another week or 2 weeks to get published, and then we'll have a special website for it, and I'll beg and plead for you to help contribute to the cause. What's $9.99 so that we can have better research about sexual addiction, right? Okay, well, that's my commercial for this book that I'm not making a penny on. As a matter of fact, I'm spending lots of money to get it going because I so believe in this project. And it's going to be called, I'm not really sure. I have to actually have the title approved, but something like Wisdom from the Masters on Sexual Addiction and Partner Recovery. So that's what I'm so excited to be talking about and working on this book. Now, tonight we're going to be talking about love addiction because especially women who think they're sex addicts may actually be love addicts. And, you know, I understand that it can be very convoluted. It can be very confusing because sometimes they look alike. And so I thought I would educate you a little bit on love addiction. I actually had somebody who was going to talk to you about her own love addiction and share her story. And then a friend of hers died today, and she was pretty upset. And, you know, she said, hey, maybe I'll be able to do the show. And I just said, well, take care of yourself. If you need the distraction, feel free to come on. But, you know, I can't imagine. It's probably going to be very difficult for her, and I hope she just takes very good care of herself. Now, what is love addiction, right? Well, it is an obsessive-compulsive process that someone participates in to relieve or medicate this really intolerable relationship deficit that originated in childhood. Now, I know that sounds like a very complicated definition, but it really isn't. What I mean by that is if you didn't get your needs met as a child, if you weren't validated, it could very well result in you developing this kind of obsessive compulsive need to be loved. And when you get that, no matter how short-lived that is, it medicates you and it makes you feel whole. Now, the unconscious part of the brain cannot distinguish between normal love and love addiction in these kind of folks. In other words, people who have sex addiction may have the basic pathway to the addiction, but the biochemistry is different due to the neurochemicals that are released. Sex addicts are addicted to sex, but with love addiction, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with love. It's about the hole that it fills. And so, in some ways, love addiction works on filling a hole, and there may be a sexual component to that. Now, typically, there are three types of love addiction. There's either that romance, rush, or infatuation type. That's when somebody is intoxicated by infatuation, and it either produces dopamine or PEA, and that causes a craving. Or the second kind of, or second type of love addiction is the relationship type that's motivated by the fantasy of a real relationship. And that one produces oxytocin. And lastly, there's this third type, and it has to do with the conquest, the chase. You know, when there's a lot of people out there that really love, they really love to conquer and conquest. And when they do that, that is the high. And once they find the person, get to, you know that they have that person in their life, well, then what ends up happening is they no longer want the person. And so the love addiction is not love addiction at all. It is catch and conquer. Now, this neurochemical high lights up the reward center in the brain just in the same way a sex addiction does. However, it has a really strong psychological component to it. And it absolutely reduces stress, increases focus, and regulates mood. So it is really condition that highly affects the central nervous system. And so we're always looking at, okay, how does it affect the neurochemistry and how is it a neurochemical high? Now, phenylethylamine, which is PEA, is a chemical release in the brain that occurs when you experience infatuation and euphoria. It gives that feeling of happiness and it increases confidence. So I don't know if that has ever happened to you before, where you felt this high because ultimately you had that chemical release in your brain and you felt euphoric. Well, people with love addiction are always looking for that high. And so oftentimes what happens, especially in probably 60 to 70% of all love addicts, is they love that high and they look for that high and they get that high, but they can't sustain that high. So what ends up happening is that they get really, really disappointed by the people they care about. And they keep going after that person and after that person and after that person. And the relationship is worse and worse and worse. And ultimately, if somebody were watching, they would say, what do you mean you were standing out in the rain watching for him to come home because you believed that he was out with somebody else and you wanted to catch him? You know, that's not a feel-good high, but that person is chasing after that person because, you know, the addict is chasing after that person because he or she can't imagine being without the high. So they have to know that that high is within reach. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever seen this video. It is absolutely amazing. I show it at almost every conference. It's called the Still Face Video. And it shows a mother who is sitting in front of her baby, and she is really bonding with the baby. And they're having loving moments. And it's just, you know, it's amazing to watch this baby really relate to her mother. And then the mother is instructed to be absolutely still, to show no expression, to not reach out to the baby, but to act catatonic. And you see this baby within 15 seconds start to freak out, start to cry, to reach out to her mother, to squeal. She wants her mother's attention, and she doesn't like that her mother has gone catatonic. And they do this for about a minute and a half. And you think about how just a 2.5-minute clip with a healthy mother and a healthy baby. Just imagine, if you would, your own childhoods. And I know that a lot of people listening tonight have lived with abusive or neglectful parents. Maybe they drank. Maybe they used drugs. Maybe they were emotionally unavailable. And when that occurs in your childhood, you have these big gaping wounds. I call them wounded souls. And you may look for a relationship to make you feel whole. And that's truly what many people with love addiction do. They look for that relationship. They look for that bonding. You know, they don't want to feel that insecurity and that sadness. So, you know, kids who miss that opportunity for nurture stay emotionally stuck and continue to want to find partners who will nurture and connect with them. And oftentimes at the beginning of a relationship, you get this adrenaline high, this dopamine high, this euphoria, and you feel like you're in the perfect relationship, and you go for this fantasy. And when that happens, you know, then you kind of reverse back to being whatever age you were when you first didn't get it. And what we know about love addicts is they usually get stuck initially at age 3. So when a client looks for a rush, and they're working with me, I know that oftentimes they'll think I'm the greatest person in the world. I am a mother figure. I was a mother figure at 24, let alone now that I'm 60. And I really talk to people who have love addiction, and I say, don't idealize me. Don't put me on a pedestal. I'm going to fall off. You know, we need to have a very stable relationship. But I take myself off that pedestal because, again, love addicts go right for the fantasy. You know, when a child doesn't get what they need, they have what we call relational trauma. It actually registers in the brain as trauma, and it gets locked in there. And this leaves a huge impact on, you know, relational skills and choices. It just does. And then when further trauma occurs, you know, you meet somebody and he or she rejects you. You meet somebody and he or she abandons you. Then clearly you re-experience that relational trauma, and you further fortify that person's belief that they're not going to get their needs met. So as you're thinking about this, did you have significant trauma in your early development? And if you did, then my next question would be, how have you been able to work through the trauma? Have you got a good trauma therapist? Are you working with a certified sexual addictions therapist? Do you have a minister or pastor who understands your wounds and respects them and helps you walk through them and get over them? Because that's what you really need. And oftentimes you need a specialist. You've heard me talk about EMDR. EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing. And it's especially helpful in processing the trauma that you've experienced and reframing it. When you do EMDR, you have to be certified and trained. So you've got to look for a specialist. They can help you to process stuck and stored implicit and explicit memories that have caused these big gaping wounds in your life. And so I would encourage you, if this sounds like you, to please seek help and find a trauma specialist who can do EMDR. Now, I also say you really need somebody who can help you to learn how to reframe. And reframing is when you are able to see your wounds, to see things that are not working in your life, to know what your weaknesses are, and to look at them and say, okay, now how can that help me grow stronger? What is that going to do for me? You know, what skills am I going to learn because of it? And when you reframe, you develop resiliency skills. And that's always a great thing. Because in life, we all have to be resilient. You know, I was saying earlier in the show that I got my first, it wasn't hate email, but, it, you know, he just really, how could you do this? And where's your conscience? And you're just part of the mess, blah, blah, blah. And there was a part of me that just wanted to delete it. I thought, I'm not going to give this guy the time of day. That is not what I did. He's not worth my time. And then I thought, you know, you could explain yourself and in a non-defensive way and hope that he understands. I did. I thought that. And then the last thing that I did was I said to myself, you know what? This guy deserves to say, hey, I appreciate your feedback. I admire the fact that you took the time. And I sure didn't mean, that was not my intention to talk about him in that way. I'm sorry you felt that way, but thanks again. And so I did that. And as a result, he emailed me back with much, much, much softer jargon, said he appreciated me appreciating him. And it was just a wonderful thing. And so that's reframing. That's taking a situation and saying, okay, now how can you grow stronger from it? What can you learn from it? And that's truly one of the resiliencies of life. Now, it looks like I may have my guest on the line. And is that you, Danielle?
It is me. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I am fine. I've already told our listening audience that I wasn't sure that you were going to be able to come on because obviously you experienced a trauma today. And so at any point, if you feel like you just can't go on or you need to take a break, you let us know, okay?
Absolutely.
I was just going over a little bit about love addiction because I wanted our audience to know a little bit about the definition of love addiction. And I know that that's what you're going to be talking about tonight because so many people wonder, does love addiction really exist? And how is it different from sex addiction? And then how are the treatments different? And certainly you've got some expertise with love addiction, correct?
I would say so. I would say so.
So can you tell me, you know, so many people know that there are 12-step groups, and I know that you use one for love addiction. How would you first define what love addiction means to you?
For me, I would say that it's any time that I'm trying to engage myself in a situation to escape my reality. And that's a definition that is continuing to unfold, and I'm continuing to learn more of what that means for myself. But love addiction for me looks like escape. It looks like me feeling that there's a lack in myself and chasing after someone else to fill that void.
Oh, boy. And so I was talking to the audience earlier, and I said usually when you want to fill that void, there's like a wounded soul. There's been some sort of neglect or abuse in one's childhood that has helped to create that developmental need to fill it. Did that occur in your life?
Absolutely, and I agree with you 100% on that. I spent a lot of my time as I was growing up. Well, first of all, I was sexually abused as a young girl. So for me, that sent all kind of messages to me. One, that my body wasn't mine and that anyone could manipulate it whenever they wanted to. But also that flipped that switch for me to equate sex with love. And I spent, you know, pretty much my entire adult life up until, you know, about a year or so ago when I got in the room, thinking that sex equated to love and chasing after individuals to love me because I did not feel very loved or wanted or needed, or I never felt enough, et cetera. So I definitely feel like mine, at least I can speak for myself, I feel like my addiction did stem from trauma that took place with me early in my life.
About what age do you remember being sexually abused?
For me, it started around age 5 or 6. Honestly, and it's kind of, you know, I vaguely remember some of what took place, but I know that it was around those ages when it started happening.
Okay, and so is there a part of you that fights that need to be 5 years old again? You know, one of the things that I've read about love addiction and have seen in my own practice is that people are stuck developmentally at the age where there was severe neglect or abuse. And if it started at age 5, there's a little 5-year-old inside of you wanting love.
Yes, and I'm just getting around to the point where I'm even acknowledging that. I think the last maybe 2 or 3 years where I've started participating in a 12-step fellowship that addresses sex and love addiction specifically, and also I've participated in support groups outside of 12 steps that were dedicated to women who have experienced sexual trauma in their life. So I've had to do some work to get around to the point where I even realize that there is that 5-year-old inside of myself who feels neglected and unloved. And that's generally how I show up in relationships that are unhealthy for me, or when I'm acting out unhealthy behaviors in relationships, probably about 5 or 6 years old in my mental approach.
Okay, and I don't know if I heard you correctly, so I want to get a little clarification. Did you, obviously you're talking about 12-step groups like Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, right, SLAA?
Sure.
And then did I hear you say something about in the room?
No, I did not. But I participated in other groups that weren't affiliated with 12 steps that addressed sexual trauma specifically for women.
Oh, very interesting. The reason I asked that is that there is for sex addicts and love addicts on Friday nights a website called In the Room. And it's for people to have dialogue and to get to talk. They don't have to, but they can talk with each other. They can actually see each other. It's kind of the newest type of 12-step. Well, it's not 12-step, but it's the newest kind of support group available for, and especially for the gay and lesbian culture. So I just wondered if you had experienced that.
I have not, but that's definitely something that I will look into.
Yeah, my friend Rob Weiss, who is a vice president of the Elements, is facilitating that, and I've heard a lot of good things about it, so I thought, knowing you, you seem to have your finger on the pulse of a lot of different kind of treatment. I thought, knowing you, you've probably already heard about it and you've participated. So what? Tell me what the difference is between Cell AA group, of course, Sex and Love, Addicts Anonymous, and an SAA 12-step group, which is Sex Addicts Anonymous.
Right. So my experience, because I've attended both meetings for both fellowships, and what I've experienced Sex Addicts Anonymous to be is strictly focused on sexual encounters, sexual behavior that promote unhealthiness. For me, I felt like the Sex Addicts Anonymous was more geared towards the specific behavior of engaging in sexual practices that were unhealthy. Now, what I feel in the sex and love addiction meetings is addressing that relationship component, you know, the addiction to actually wanting to be in relationship, the need to be needed. Almost like, to me, it feels like addressing the codependency that can come along with relationships when they're conducted in an unhealthy way. I get that in my SLAA meetings, and I didn't feel that in the Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings.
Well, and aren't there, you know, obviously you have SAA groups that are male-oriented, then you have the exclusive female SAA groups, and in SLAA, it's predominantly women, but men are encouraged to come, correct?
Absolutely, and there's a meeting that I attend currently in the area where I'm now living, and it's kind of split down the middle almost. There's about the same amount of women that attend as well as men. And I've been really glad about that because I've been in meetings that were very one-sided where I was the only woman there lots of the time. The majority of the time, actually, I'd be the only woman in the meeting.
Well, that's interesting. Now, for any of our listeners out there that are wondering, you know, am I a sex addict? Could I be a sex addict and a love addict? Or am I a love addict? How do you know if you're participating in an addictive relationship?
For me, I lose myself in a person or the relationship in general. I call this pushing my boundaries back. When I start seeing myself pushing boundaries back to accommodate a situation or a person, I'm understanding that I'm in an addictive relationship. Because relationships for me that aren't addictive and stem in healthy connections, they respect my boundaries, and I respect the boundaries of others. So when I find myself going outside of what matters to me, you know, when I find myself allowing my feelings to be hurt over and over, or when I find myself hurting someone else's feelings, or more importantly, when I'm expecting someone to rescue me from some situation, or I'm thinking I'm going to rescue someone from some situation, then those are like telltale signs for me that I am in a situation that's not healthy.
And so then what do you do about that as you begin to feel that telltale sign that, okay, this is not healthy for me? What's the next step?
Well, I have to be honest, prior to program, and maybe just even to say the last couple months, I would just kind of stay in a situation like that. I don't like ending things, so I would kind of wait around until the other person ended the thing. But lately, in situations where, and I've had one situation where I was dating someone and it came down to me understanding that it was unhealthy for me, completely cut it off. You know, I understood that it wasn't conducive to health or what I want a healthy relationship to look like, and so I cut it off respectfully. And there was no sexual encounter or anything like that. I was simply getting to know this person. And so it felt better for me emotionally to cut it off because I hadn't gone to that next step with them.
And then were you honest about that or did you disappear?
No, I was very honest with them about how I felt around certain things and why I thought we weren't a good match.
Oh, good for you, because that, of course, is kind of the righting of the wrongs in terms of you pick the wrong person, so at least end the relationship in the right way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so again, you kind of know if you're in an addictive relationship, if in some ways it feels like they're actually completing you. They're filling that void. They're making you feel whole, whether it be that they're validating you or you're actually taking over, you're codependent with them, if you will.
Yes. And I have to tell you, Carol, I watched a lot of television growing up. So I bought into this whole notion of, okay, I'm going to show up 50% and this person's going to show up 50% and we're going to make a whole. And as I become, you know, more of an adult, I understand that that's just not the way this works. Two people show up 100%, give 100% and meet each other in the middle somewhere and work together is the way I see a healthy relationship going for myself. If I'm showing up to the situation 50%, I don't need to be there until I'm 100%. And I mean that in a way of I know we're never perfect, so I'm not saying it in that way. I'm just saying it's unfair to someone else if I'm dumping my stuff off onto them because I'm not doing the work to take care of myself.
Well, 100%. Now, in your lifetime, have you ever met somebody that you felt was relatively healthy?
In my lifetime, honestly, from where I've been, some of the spaces that I found myself in, I think like attracts to like I've been very healthy, so I don't think I've attracted very healthy individuals.
Okay, so then of course I'm going to ask you, what's the longest amount of time you've had where you've really been single and by yourself, getting to know yourself better?
That's a great question. Honestly, I spent about, when I first started in program, I spent about 6 months without being sexually active and not actively trying to date someone. So about 6 months or so in my adult life.
And then was it almost as if you were withdrawing? Because obviously you used people to fill that void. You've used men. Or women.
Or both.
Yeah, or both, yeah. So
it was absolutely like I was withdrawing. Yes, it was like I was withdrawing. And there's even a chapter in the text that we have for SLAA that talks about the withdrawal process and what it feels like.
Really? Okay, so then tell me a little bit about that. What is the withdrawal when you know that you're a love addict?
Well, it looks like cutting off all connections or, you know, however that looks for the individual, connections that I'm addicted to is what it looks like for me. And to tell you the truth, I'm in a process right now where I'm getting kind of reacquainted with some of that. I'm not dating right now by choice, and I'm also not active right now by choice. And It feels like I guess one would think. I have these times where my mind is trying to play tricks on me and telling me, hey, you're 32 now. You should be trying to find someone to settle down with and get married, and you don't have a lot of time. And, you know, my inner addict can tell me anything to try to get me to take my will back in these situations.
Wow, good point. So, okay. Your inner self tries to fool you and wants you to return back to being a love addict, and you're working on what it's like to be single and to get to know yourself better.
Right, because that's essential. And that's the other thing that I'm coming to understand as I continue to work the steps in the program with the sponsor. It is absolutely essential for one to know themselves before they try to engage with another person. Because something that's been said to me recently that's really put a lot on my mind is, if I don't like spending time alone with myself, what makes me think that someone else would? You know, how could I expect someone else to want to spend time with me if I haven't come to understand just how beautiful it is to spend time with myself? So that's kind of what I spend my days doing now, is enjoying my own company and knowing that it's okay.
Well, good for you, because I know that for a lot of people, that's a foreign concept. You know, when they need somebody to complete them, then they're always on the hunt and chase to find that someone. And so you said you've gone 6 months, and that's the longest amount of time you've actually been without. And I'm assuming when you say that, you also mean that you're sexually celibate also.
Right. Yeah, I was sexually celibate at that time. And also, let me tell you, I have found myself in very long relationships with people, which is why that 6 months is the amount of time it's been. My very first relationship during college, I was with someone for almost 7 years, and they broke that relationship off because I wasn't faithful, and I got right into a relationship right after that I was in for about 3 years. So I've been one to jump into relationships to try to force myself to be with one person, and it never worked.
Mm-hmm. Well, 7 years was a long time, and I am really impressed with the fact that somehow, some way, you have known that it's important to look at this love addiction and to spend time with yourself. I mean, that's a really brave and courageous thing. Now, you mentioned the website, and I know for SLAA, they have a great test on the homepage that helps to determine if you might have a sex and love addiction. So did you ever take that test?
I have taken that test before, but I actually took it after I was in the fellowship. Funny thing is, I was just telling someone this story. They asked me, how did you end up in SLAA? And I'm in another fellowship, and I was talking in that fellowship one day. I was sharing, and I started talking about, you know, other things that coincided with SLAA, and someone came to me afterwards and was like, hey, there's a program for that. So that's how I came to know that there was a fellowship for sex and love addiction.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you say that, because truly when you talk and you trust others with your feelings, good things will come to you. And that obviously was one of the good things, is that somebody said, hey, there's a program for that. And you wouldn't have figured that out if you hadn't, you know, found a way to talk, trust, and feel.
Very true. Very true. And honestly, what you just said there has been driving the last maybe almost 6 years of my life, which is how long I've been in 12-step recovery programming. Me talking with others and sharing honestly about what I'm experiencing, it opens me up to get suggestions from others on how they handle life, addictions, and afflictions. You know, I know people that work multiple programs and are living fairly good lives, you know, life on life's terms, and they don't have to act out in these ways one day at a time. And so I get hope and inspiration from these individuals by sharing with them some of what I have going on and listening to some of what they have going on as well.
Well, I bet. Now, let me ask you, some people would say that all addictions are the same, you know, drug, alcohol, gambling, spending, sex, love. Do you think that a sex and love addiction is as serious as, say, a drug or alcohol addiction?
I do. And on some levels, I would venture to say that is even more serious, and not to discredit or discount in any way a drug or an alcohol addiction. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, we can live without drugs. We can live without alcohol. We don't need those things on a daily basis. On a daily basis to function. But we do need companionship and affection from others. You know, that's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Love. That is a part of, we need that. And so when that compass is out of whack as to what that looks like healthily, that is self-destruction. And I feel like it affects my mental health mostly. And I think that it's just like any of those other drugs that we can use. We get that hit. We get that dopamine release. So it's the same thing going on there. But I watched a movie one time that specifically addressed sex addiction, and this guy talked about how difficult it was to quit this drug when the pipe is attached to your body. And, you know, of course, he was meaning his penis. But, you know, how does one navigate all of that, it can be very difficult when what it is that causes you turmoil is always with you. Like, you know, you can take yourself away from drugs and alcohol, but you can't take yourself away from yourself.
Well, good point. And so, again, you're not saying anything about any of the others, but you would say it's as difficult, if not worse, because you're always with a part of yourself, whether it be a body part, a penis, or your heart.
Absolutely. That's always there. And so one has to learn how to deal with that, meaning take my own situation. You know, I can assure you that I have spent way more years on the side of addiction and compulsion and acting out than I have spent on the side of, you know, health and wellness around conducting relationships. So it's always there for me to want to go back to that other side. And I imagine that it's always there for someone who has an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction as well. But, you know, there's this intrigue. I can see a man or a woman walking down the street and create an entire story around that person. Like, my addiction has been one where I do not spend a lot of time in reality when it comes to relating to others. So I'm having to learn how to see real people and not just figments of my imagination and fantasy.
Well, and you just hit the nail on the head. Certainly with love addiction, it's all about fantasy. And whereas sexual addiction, one component, one type of sex addiction is fantasy. With love addiction, it's almost always fantasy.
Yes, and I have learned that for myself, that I can't spend too much time in fantasy because, one, it's going to cause me to want to act out physically if I spend too much time with it. And two, the more time I spend in fantasy around an individual, that individual in and of themselves, they disappear to me. And they become this object, this figment of my imagination that's only there for my satisfaction, for my needs, for my whatever it is that I'm wanting them there for. And they're no longer a person to me. I don't know if that makes sense, but with my fantasies, I completely start erasing a person.
Well, absolutely. And I was saying before you came on the call, for so many people, that adrenaline rush from that infatuation and beginning stages of a relationship that quickly dies or, you know, gets minimized and then the real relationship comes into play, those people with a love addiction don't necessarily want that secondary stage. They want to stay in the fantasy stage because that's the part that completes them. That's the part that fills that wounded soul. And so a lot of what you're talking about is staying in the fantasy as a medication for the wounds that you had as a kid.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me years of therapy, thousands of dollars, and countless of hours to get around to that for myself. Once I get past that point of infatuation where we really start to see each other and, you know, our character defects and flaws and things of that nature start coming out, I get really afraid and freaked out because I have a serious fear of intimacy, very serious fear of it.
Well,
and it's the weirdest thing to me. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I've talked to my listeners before about there's five typical fears of intimacy, and they are fear of abandonment, fear of rejection, fear of being hurt, fear of hurting others, and then fear of merger, losing oneself. And if you had to pick your top fear, what would it be?
It would be fear of abandonment.
Okay, and why?
I am completely afraid that I would put all of myself into a situation and the other person would decide that all of myself was not enough and go away, and then I would be left picking up the pieces. And I wonder what picking up the pieces would look like or if I would even really be able to pick up the pieces. And as I say that out loud to you, I have had to pick up the pieces in so many areas of my life, and I've done just fine with it. So I don't know why that fear is so pressing for me, but it really is.
Interesting. Okay. Now, one of the questions that I get asked the most when I'm asking someone to work on their sex and love addiction is they say, okay, does that mean that I'm not going to be able to have sex for my first year of recovery? What does the program advocate in terms of celibacy for somebody who, you know, is working a strong SLAA program?
Right. For me, and I'm not very sure if there is an actual suggestion, I have heard a year of being in program and being celibate for one to go through withdrawal and, you know, work the steps with a sponsor, et cetera. My sponsor, we had a conversation and we decided on 6 months. And that was because I'd been in another 12-step fellowship. I'd worked through the steps a couple of times, and all kind of other things went into us making that decision collectively. But if I had to give a suggestion to someone, I definitely would say at least 6 months.
Okay, so your suggestion, if you were being a sponsor, or certainly what has worked for you, is 6 months of celibacy so that you can really get to know your real needs.
Yes, because for me, I spent those first probably 2 months really in a very bad space. And when I say bad, I mean in a space where I was grieving the loss of all the ways that I had chosen to act out.
Yeah, I definitely think that it uncomplicates things when you're not being sexual with somebody, because let's face it, if that is really hard for anybody to distinguish, is this just sex or is it love, and how do both of those processes make me feel?
Right, right. And I saw that very clearly with a recent situation that I mentioned a little earlier when we started talking. You know, I've been seeing this person for not too long, you know, a little over a month. And we'd done nothing sexual. We hadn't even been in each other's space before, you know, each other's homes, only gone out on a couple of dates and talked on the phone quite a bit. But I saw just how, and there's a difference between easy and simple, of course, but I saw just how simple it was for me to end this connection with this person, because there was nothing that I felt like I had compromised of myself to participate in the situation. You know, had I slept with this person or given more than I'd given, it would have been difficult. And like you said, I would have started questioning, okay, well, since we've done that, does it mean that it's love and I need to hold out for a little longer? And I, you know, I get into these really foggy spaces when I participate in sexual encounters with someone too early.
So then how do you meet your sexual needs when you're in agreement that you're going to be celibate? What do you do to cope with wanting to be sexual?
Well, this is something that I've had countless conversations with my sponsor around. I, at times, do masturbate, but there are also people in the program who do not. That's not a part of their abstinence, and they just don't participate in sex with others or sex with self outside of a committed relationship. It really depends on what is healthy for the individual who's working the program.
Okay, so what I clearly hear you saying is that's an individual choice, and you don't find masturbation as a trigger to lighting up the reward center and then making you crave sex with somebody else more. You find it as a way to meet your own needs.
Now, I have to be very careful with that and get very honest. There are times when I have used masturbation to escape, and when I get into those spaces, I have to be very honest with my sponsor about what's going on, and generally I end up having to back off completely for some time to get myself back centered and before I can even do that. And then there have been periods where, not even planned, but I have had no desire at all, and I don't do it. I just go through life, you know, without sex or masturbation altogether. So it's been pretty here, there, and everywhere for me around that.
Well, and I imagine that you would tell others that that's something that they need to discuss with their fellowship and especially their sponsor and then come
absolutely
up with their own agenda, boundaries, expectations for themselves.
Yes. I feel like being rigorously
okay,
honest.
Okay, as we begin to
important
wrap up, what would you tell anybody who's listening to the show who thinks, she sounds like me. I do the same things. What would you tell them to do next in terms of finding recovery?
Well, if they weren't already seeing a therapist, I would suggest that they do that for themselves if they were able to do that. If that wasn't an option for them for whatever reason, I would definitely suggest that they try to check out a local meeting in their area or an online meeting for Sex Addicts Anonymous or Sex and Love Addiction. Maybe even find that website and take that quiz to see if that's something that they even need to do. But I definitely would suggest doing more investigation around how they could receive the proper help that they needed.
Yeah, good point. So take the quiz that's on the SLAA homepage. Get to a therapist who has expertise in either love and or sex addiction or somebody who's good with trauma, who may be an abuse specialist and can help with all those childhood wounds, and then get yourself to a 12-step fellowship program, either face-to-face, if your city has one, or online. And so people that may not understand that you can go online and do a telephone meeting by putting that Googling SLAA telephone meetings, and that a website will come up and it will give you meetings all different days during the week, and hopefully one will fit your individual schedule.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Daniel, I know you've had a rough day, and, you know, again, I am very sorry for your loss, and are you going to be able to take care of yourself tomorrow?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have friends who have agreed to spend time with me tomorrow. I had a friend that went out to dinner with me tonight. So I have lots of support. And actually being able to talk with you was very helpful as well. It gave me something to do for a little while. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, absolutely. And we'll have you back on in October. I mean, you are a deep thinker, and I know that you've always got topics that you think would help our audience. So I thank you so much for coming on today, and I look forward to working with you again.
All right. Well, you have a good rest of your evening. We'll talk soon.
Okay. It's a deal. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Obviously, a very strong and wise woman who believes, like so many other addicts, that, you know, it's important to help others by sharing your story. Tonight we heard a little bit about a love addiction and Danielle, and thank you again, Danielle. And as I say at the end of every show, you know, there'll only be one of you at all times, so I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and we will catch you next week, same time, same place, 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Have a good week.